there, Shopomaniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, web design podcast about web design and doing web design throughout the ages, ages, ages. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer.
Hi! We're going to talk about now, the present of web design, and we decided we're gonna dive into the past a little bit, and who more perfect to do that with than Jen Robbins? Hey, Jen, how are you?
Hi, how are you? Happy to be here.
Good. Yeah. Thanks for coming on the show. So, Jen, you have I don't know. It's tempting to call it a new book, but really, it's the fifth edition of a book. So, how does it? What's the book and how does it feel to be in its fifth edition?
Fifth edition, I know. So, it's Learning Web Design. The first one was written in 2000, and here we are nearly...
God, how's your SEO on that? I'm going to try it right now.
Nearly 20 years later. every edition practically is a new book. There were 6 years between the fourth and the fifth edition, and a lot happened in those 6 years. Mobile and
sure,
cell phones.
When was it? 2012 was edition one.
Yes, that was the fourth edition.
Yeah. Oh, that was the fourth edition. So when was the first?
The first edition was written in 2000.
Wow. Yeah,
and released in 2001. So I've been writing. My first book on web design came out in 1995. Yeah. I've been at this a long time. I'm one of the old timers. I'm one of the web design old timers.
Well, listen to this blurb, everybody. You'll enjoy this. Jennifer Robbins has 25 years of web design experience, having designed the first commercial website. Let that sink in, folks. O'Reilly's Global Network Navigator, GNN, in 1993. I was not designing websites in 1993, nor was Dave, I'm very sure.
Quite literally, the first .com here, is this... commercial.
I think as we defined it, it was Global Network Navigator. It was weeks after they just cleared commercial use for the web because it had been just used for scientific papers and mostly academic. And they passed some sort of rule that, okay, we'll open this up to commerce. And Dale Doherty, who was an editor at O'Reilly, said, hey, let's publish on this and let's make a magazine type thing where we fund it with advertising. So that was the first commercial use. It was early 93, I believe. And... there were about 48 web servers worldwide. 138 web servers worldwide when we started. So I remember sitting down and just looking at it and just not knowing what I was looking at all. And it was kind of nice to write my first book from that point of naivete. I just didn't, I still remember what it was like just not even being able to parse what I was looking at. And I had never seen code really before. So for me, looking at the source file was a really interesting thing. But mostly I worked on look and feel and graphics and brand identity. And we'd have meetings where we'd sit down like, what would it be like to buy something with a credit card on a web page? And what would, how?
Like well before that was possible.
Right. And how do we make people know that the ads on the page are ads? So I have sketches where we were putting ads in little frames that said advertising. And so we were really working on the very first banner ads back in 93. Yeah. That when we started, there was only one browser and only worked on Unix. So I had to run Mac X on my Mac in order to look at web pages.
Dang.
It was really interesting. So I've had really a front row seat to... all of it.
You really have. I think it's fascinating to think that the first website, there was already we should sell stuff on here and get some ads up on there. Day one.
Yeah.
That's a little close to me, isn't it?
Well, I'll tell you, when we were working on GNN and thinking about advertising, we were assuming, and it seems so quaint now, that because we had all this, infinite space that, it wouldn't just be, flashy animated ads, we'd have like all the information about the product. So it wouldn't just be a car ad. It would be like all the specifications and really deep informational type of advertising that hadn't been seen before. And as it turned out, it just ended up being flashy animations. But like,
we had so much opportunity.
Yeah, we really were thinking of advertising in a more informational way in those early days.
Wow, that's incredible.
It is, because it's like, why, and they still are not so great. You know, there's still companies are like, well, here's just my 300 by 300. Can you run that? It's a JPEG. You know, like, oh, it could be so awesome, though.
Right. Or even just linking to more information. But
yeah,
we had some interesting perspective on things back then.
Yeah, I was going to say, since you were in it, like in doing it and inventing it, was it kind of, were the arguments back then like, let's do what print does, you know, print sells these little bricks and we just chuck them on the page. And then I'm sure somebody was like, yeah, but the web, we can like, you know, use TV basically inside of there. Like, what were the conversations kind of about, like how the first advertisement would ever, you know, I'm curious, way curious about how these conversations went.
Well, you'd have to talk to Dale Dougherty more about the thinking, because he was the thinking person behind all of the GNN work. But I do know, I mean, it was so primitive. We had, you know, HTML1 tags. The very first, you know, there were probably 18 tags total to format the page. It's well before.
Mm-hmm. And not even really an image tag.
We did have the image tag. However, okay. Here's an interesting thing. I believe that the alt attribute was a GNN-generated addition to the image tag.
Oh, wow.
So that was, I recall when we had our 20th anniversary get-together, that Dale was talking about how, you know, and we were in with the W3C, you know. they would have their meetings at the O'Reilly office. And that was one of the things. It's like, hey, we need a way to, if the image doesn't display, to have a backup. And I think they got the alt text, you know, the alt attribute in there. Sort of generated
right
on our
now,
need.
Somebody's on stage somewhere at a conference being like, all your images should have alt text. It is extremely important for accessibility, you know, which is a great message. But just, I mean, somebody's every day people are delivering that message still. It's great.
Yeah. So it was really fun being there in the beginning and sort of learning slowly as it developed. It's just gone so exponentially, though. It's as everyone knows, it's really hard to keep up with this stuff. But back in 94, we had been doing about a year. I started doing some speaking at like Siebold conferences. And there's a saying around O'Reilly that like everyone has a book in them. So it didn't take long for people, in particular, my boss, Edie Friedman. She's the woman who was responsible for putting the animals on the covers of O'Reilly books. And she said, Jen, you have to write a book about this, which I could not write. Like, I would break out in hives at a 2-page paper when I was in college. And so the prospect of writing a book seemed impossible. But I did write a lot of emails to another designer at O'Reilly who was in the California office. I was in Cambridge. And he would say, hey, how do I, you know, make this, you know, graphic transparent? And I'd say, oh, well, first you open it, open this utility app and open this other utility app. And I was always giving him instructions. So I wrote my first book as a series of emails to Ted. I'd make an outline and then just as though I was just telling him, like, okay, here's how you do it.
Yeah.
And I really think that conversational tone, like just me talking to a friend, has made it all the way through to this new edition. And people like that. That's it's great. A lot more human and approachable.
So do you have a book in you out there, audience? If you do, perhaps, and it seems overwhelming to you, perhaps just write an email to your friend.
A lot of them in a row.
I have some questions. You guys say it's that easy, but you are both published authors. I have a book in me, a few books. I just mostly have book titles. That's my problem.
Book titles, yes. I remember, God, there's been some good ones over the years, hasn't there, Dave? Money-driven
management.
Money-driven management, that's a good one, yeah.
Background pink-driven development.
94 was the last year mentioned here, but it was until 2000 when this book comes out, right?
Well, so no, 94, I started writing my first book, which was called Designing for the Web. It came out the same day as Linda Weinman's book and was lost in the dustbins of history, which is good because there's so much bad advice in it. It's really, it's terrible. There's some real... When you hear one of my most embarrassing.
Was it good advice at the time, or was not even then?
It's really like the only place to research it was just asking people around the office, you know, around the O'Reilly office. Yeah. So
there's 168 websites.
I have this cover for this book looks really familiar. What's in there? What's the embarrassing?
Okay, so the embarrassing one was trying to come up with a recommended resolution for web images. So the thought was, I can't even get through this. So so Macs used 72 DPI screens, and Windows machines were 96 DPI. So someone told me that make your graphics 88 DPI because you could split it down the middle,
which just right in the
which
middle.
Works. But yeah, I mean, the point is, you know, like it's irrelevant, like what the your image format, you know. But I was out there telling everyone, yeah, 88 pixels per inch.
That'll do.
88. Yeah. That's your magic number.
It really is irrelevant, right? It's like,
yeah, it's like, it's just pixel to pixel. Yeah, it's just, which I did fix in a later edition. So, but then the big book that really got me into like author status was Web Design in a Nutshell. And
a couple years later, that
the first edition came out in. 99, early 99. So I wrote that in 98. And that was really the big one that, you know, had Weasel on the cover. So it was one of, you know, O'Reilly's notable books.
Was it? Do weasels eat nuts? Maybe they do in this world. But anyway, so the idea was that it I don't know, what was it? Was it the title that resonated with people, or was it a perfect time?
I think it was a perfect time. And the Nutshell series for O'Reilly was a really big, well-known series. But I just realized as, you know, doing early web design work, I was just looking things up constantly. And I just felt like I just need this all in one place. So I pitched it. I said, you know, I just want to gather all this stuff that I'm always looking up into one place and do it like an encyclopedia. So the Nutshell books just have tons of stuff in them, just condensed down as much as possible. So, so my second book was Web Design in a Nutshell, and it was hundreds and hundreds of pages. It proved to be like really useful. And I talk to people now who say that that's the book that taught them web design. So I really think it,
Hey, that's great.
I think it's the first book of its type, you know, but you know, you can't go wrong writing books for what you need. You know, it's like, like if I need this, other people need this. If I don't know this, other people don't know this. And that's I think a good guideline for me always. So then after that, I wanted, you know, the Nutshell's great, but it's really, it's like an encyclopedia, you know, it's just organized by lists. But I wanted to have a book that really taught people from scratch. And that's what learning web design is. It assumes absolutely no programming or coding experience at all. In fact, in the book, I actually tell people how to open TextEdit and Notepad and configure it to save HTML files. And, you know, it's not condescending. It's really like, okay, you're just starting out here. Let's start at square zero. You know, let's just really get you started from nothing. And by the end, I you know, people are, you can do, you know, responsive layouts with grid and, you know, all according to best practices with, you know, progressive so enhancements.
It's a journey forward. I mean, and this is, 100% up to date now. Like this just came out. Learning Web Design, fifth edition, starts from nothing, ends with building a nice responsive site. And you talk about all the stuff that we would expect web designers to know today, like Flexbox and SVG and all the modern.
That's stuff. Right. Yeah. And it's interesting how even things that have been the same since my first edition in like 1999, they change. You know, things that I just assume, look, the biggest thing for this edition, the graphics chapters. I have used the same graphics, you know, text mostly since the first edition of the Nutshell. Like that stuff just, you know, I had to, you know, at one point I had to add pings, but for the most part, it's just been exactly the same. Well, there's been such a huge upheaval in the graphics world, you know, starting with SVG being your first, you know, go-to. And then, you know, and PNG completely taking over the scene from GIF, because that's, it's like, I call it old grandpa in the book, because it's heading for retirement, I think. New programs don't even support it. And just different strategies. Like, I'm going to be making lots of this one image at all different sizes and crops and resolutions. And the advice has just really changed. So that really got turned upside down. And it was kind of really caught me by surprise. I told my editor, oh, yeah, I'll be done by Thanksgiving. And then I just cracked open the graphics thinking, oh, I just have to update the URLs and maybe maybe update the group samples. And it turned out two completely rewritten chapters and a whole entire new SVG chapter, which was really just a small sidebar in the last edition. So it's interesting how things change from edition to edition.
Whenever somebody asks me about images on the web, I'm like, have you seen Jason Grigsby's 12-part series on his blog, on the Cloud 4 blog, about how to put an image on a page? And it can be that complicated, you know?
I reference that in the book too. I always send people to the good resources.
It's just such a, but this is cool. This is so kind of, I think a lot of people, you know, especially Shop Talk listeners, might be in the, oh, I want to, you know, get into tech, or I want to, you know, kind of maybe switch careers. Maybe I'm in tech, but I'm not like on the coding side of things. Or they, maybe you've been doing this for 6 to 12 months and you know enough to make a web page, but you've never like learned the basics. You've never kind of had a cohesive vision, I guess, or I guess understanding of the web. So your book would kind of fit those markets, right? Like those people who are kind of like looking to kind of hone or even get kind of like a foundation, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you already have a foundation, HTML and CSS, just learning, you know, Flexbox and Grid is a good addition. And I always try, you know, do my best to put everything out there with best practices. I always try to provide context so you know why you're doing something, not just, you know, do this and it'll all be fine. Like, I always try to like talk people through like, this is why this is important. Like, this extra graphic is hitting your performance, or, you know, don't do it this way because you want to keep progressive enhancement in mind. But it's also, I mean, it's written as a classroom. So like a class in a book. So it's very, you know, takes you step by step through things. Like I roll out, even just like rolling out CSS selectors a little at a time instead of just putting them all in one place. You know, it's hard, you know, it's like, okay, now you're handy, you know, through, there's exercises in the book too. So there's quizzes at the end of every chapter and exercises. So if you're, you know, just self-taught, if you're self-taught, you can just really, you know, go along with the book. But it's like once you get confident with element selectors and ID and class, then we roll out some, you know, contextual selectors and class and ID selectors. But then I also want the book to be a good reference book. So I've done extra work to make sure that everything is really easy to find. If you are just using it at your desk, all of those selectors are all in one place in an appendix. You know, everything is indexed very thoroughly. We have a gigantic index in this book. At the end of every CSS and HTML chapter, there's a table that lists, okay, these are all the things in this chapter. And since the chapters are topic-based, like if you need to know table markup, you know right where to go to find the table markup and all of the attributes that go with them. So I'm trying to do a lot of things with this one book, which is why it's 808 pages.
but that's like an appendix and index and
yeah, not, yeah, that includes everything. I think it's 700.
And it's full color and it's beautiful, and there is no animal on the cover. You get a leaf instead.
Yeah, we've been doing the sort of a leafy motif on this for the last three editions.
Trying to find some tests. Dave, are you ready for some?
Got my mouth coder open. my mouth editor.
Hold on. Okay. Yeah. How about this one? Is Theora, container format, video codec, or audio codec?
This would be Ogg Theora. Ogg Vorbis is the oh no, Ogg Vorbis is the video, because, oh, I'm messing this. Ogg Vorbis is the video. Ogg Theora is the audio. Yes?
For the record, for those listening, I have no idea what the answer is. It's just, it just has the questions. I have to look it up in the back.
If you had, let's, if just, you had just read chapter 10,
yeah,
then let's see.
Be good to go.
Then you would know that it is a video.
Ah, I got it mixed up. Okay. Dang it. I failed. I failed web design.
Oh, speaking of videos, what does the poster attribute do?
Is this a question for me? Is this a, oh, so you can, yeah, put a, you can, yep, put a static image as a poster that'll load before the video. So like, so instead of like a black video box, you can get like a cool, you know, still a thumbnail from your, like on YouTube, we call them thumbnails. It'd be a thumbnail for your video right there in HTML.
Well done.
Yes, you got it right.
For
very
for,
good.
For this and hundreds of more end of
chapter this should quest. Be a, this should be a podcast, just a quiz show podcast. I want the Shop Talk quiz show.
Yeah. It's fun. So there are ones that wouldn't work well on the radio. Like in the early chapters, there's tests on malformed HTML, which I don't know. I just am like obsessed with malformed HTML. Not only like, it's just fun that you're, as you know, we've looked at so much HTML in our lives that it like immediately pops out to us. But sometimes it's like, what's wrong with that one? And then even more interesting, what will the browser actually do with it once it?
You know, not to derail, I'm working on a site right now and I saw a table. And just right under the table, there's a faint little line, you know, like that's almost like half a cell wide from the table. And I'm like, something didn't get closed in this giant 100 line table. Something's not closed. And it's just, and it's wrapping and the browser decided right. to draw.
And even if you send it through a validator, sometimes it's like, it thinks everything is wrong mm-hmm. when something, you know, so it's like hard to pinpoint.
Exactly, so there's like a missing TD somewhere, closing TD, and I know it, and I've just been too chicken to like open it up. It's, but that's a, the amazing part. Browsers are pretty forgiving, but then they, you know, you miss a period.
You know what? Apparently, they're not forgiving about is you're just mentioning that this is, I feel like, isn't talked about it enough, or at least in the thing is that the browsers can decide to stop executing JavaScript for you, that they'll just be like, yo, too much. Like, what are the metrics?
Yeah, I don't know. This is prior to the episode. I was saying I have a client site in the script, like the IE used to do it all the time. They're like, basically like, oh, too much JavaScript. I'm going to just stop. Or do you want me to kill script or wait, you know, script not responding or whatever. And yeah, I just kind of, I don't know what's going on. It's really hard to debug that. But yeah, browsers will just be like, I'm not doing this one anymore. So at some point. So, hey.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by the widely beloved DigitalOcean. So here's the URL I'm going to send you to, my favorite URL in the world, do.co/shoptalk. Of course it is. That's $100 of free credit if you go to that URL, so you might as well do that, especially if you're playing around, want to check it up, spin some stuff up. So DigitalOcean is the easiest cloud platform to run and scale applications. From effortless administration tools to robust compute storage and networking devices, DigitalOcean provides an all-in-one cloud platform to help developers and their team save time when running and scaling their applications. So, and pricing is a big deal. So predictable and affordable pricing, you know, leave those complex pricing structures behind. Always know what your business is going to pay per month with industry-leading price performance balance there. So it's a flat pricing structure across all their global data center regions. So it's, we're talking about scalability, flexible configurations for literally any application, industry-leading price to performance, price that's consistent across regions, rapid provisioning, super predictable costs, hourly billing, and you get monitoring and alerting included. So again, the URL, do.co/shoptalk.
So Jen, you're an East Coaster, right?
That's right. I'm near Providence,
yeah,
Rhode Island.
Yeah, I think you maybe, yeah, knew my wife at one point, Miranda Mulligan.
That's right. Absolutely.
She's, yeah.
I just put that together recently.
You're interviewing Jen. Yeah. Yeah. Small world. Because she was like Boston.
Yeah.
Boston Globe and all that stuff. So she longs for the East Coast sometimes, I think. Or West. And then Artifact was out there for a while.
Yes, we're
RIP, right?
We're getting nostalgic. I was just talking to Christopher and Ari. I was in Austin recently and thought, it'll be our 5-year anniversary. Might be fun to do another one.
Oh boy. So,
really?
It's not a, it's, let's just say, I think it sounds like fun and they think it sounds like fun, but we haven't sat down to figure out, like, can we actually make this
work? If you need Shop Talk sponsored bucks, I'm sure we're willing. It's such a great conference. It was like right when Responsive was kind of happening and everyone's like, what do I do with life? it was, this conference came in and felt like it just brought everybody together on the same page and the same mindset on how we'll like overcome Responsive. I thought it was awesome.
Right.
So
thank you so much. Yeah. The thinky part of this new one is like, how do we translate that to 5 years later? For the most part, I feel like people have adjusted and it's just sort of the status quo now doing, you know, Responsive sites and considering mobile in the way we do things, including business models and billing. And those are some of the things we looked at with the first Artifact. So how do, you know, what are the topics that translate to now and what makes it still an Artifact conference? And I think maybe a focus on mobile is certainly part of it. But yeah, that's what needs to be thought about. And then just run the logistics of it. You know, it's a lot of work doing a conference and it's hard to make them, you know, it's hard not to lose money on them.
It is fascinating to think about, like, what, because people were, we decided that the web was moving towards Responsive and people were mostly excited about it and wanted to talk about it. So it was a big enough of a, like, it was kind of the perfect topic at the time. Whereas that, even if you identify what that, you know, something that's a big deal in the industry now, it doesn't mean that it'll necessarily make a great conference. Because you could say, oh, performance is just, you know, that's so huge. But, and people care about it, but will they get together in the same way?
Yeah, it was an important time. And it was another example of me not knowing something and thinking, if I don't know this stuff, I bet there's other people who would like to hear people talk about it. You know, so just another scratching my own itch, but with you know, some sort of thing that everyone can share in. And no, it was really, you know, I think it hit just at the right time with just the right topics. And oh my gosh, amazing people speaking. So we're getting, yeah, like I said, 5 years, that's enough to get nostalgic. So if enough people message me or say hello at Genville Duck, you know, at Genville, my Twitter tag, and say, yes, we want an Artifact, that'll prime the pump.
You hear that, Shop of Maniacs? Ever did it at Genville and send your support. Austin, I don't know if Austin's on the map, but
Austin, yeah, it would be Austin.
Oh man, Austin needs another conference. Oh my gosh. We have some in, you know, big ones like South By, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about Shop of Maniac conferences. We want like niche content, you know? So.
Yeah.
What happened to TXJS?
TXJS is great, but again, it's that thing. It's like very hard to plan, you know? I think maybe it's on the map to do another one, but I've talked to people. If somebody described it as like planning a wedding, you know, because you're inviting like 200, 400 people. You have to like plan meals for like speakers and book hotels and blocks of hotels and locations and all that. And if you've ever planned a wedding, it's awful. It's so much stress.
It's worse.
I didn't make any money at all on my wedding.
It's worse. It's planning a wedding plus trying to find sponsors for the wedding.
Oh, okay. So you because plan a wedding hit up your richest friends for support.
Right. That's the part I like the least. But we made such an effort to keep it affordable for, you know, independent workers that we set the price tag really low and it just didn't even come close to covering our expenses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sponsorships are really a necessity just to keep the whole thing afloat.
Well,
my favorite part is designing all the swag. Like, I designed artifact socks and notebooks, and I found really cool little mobile stickers, and we got a deal with Kind, and they gave us free granola bars, and we got, the swag part was really fun for me, and just anything in the graphic design.
I still have those socks in there in my power tool.
It's
my alpha business power move. Because if somebody starts arguing with me, I just say, "Do you have socks about websites? Because I'm wearing socks about websites right now. And if you want to talk to me, I would like to see your socks because my socks are about websites." And then we'll just see who's right. So it's my alpha business power move, and I recommend that if you're ever in negotiations. So,
well, I'll have to keep that in mind. I still have mine too.
Yeah,
no, I like them.
Oh, I could use another set if you got a if you got a bin.
I can hook you up. I think I have like three or four so left. So we'll put your name on one.
So back in the day, the web design in a nutshell, you did the addition thing for. And then stopped, I guess. It seems like maybe learning web design was like the last edition of web design in a nutshell. Then the next year was the first edition of learning web design. Maybe I have that timeline right. And then, so it seemed like, did you learn back then that doing the addition thing was like the way to go for you? Like, why not five different books over all these years instead of just doing the additions?
That's a good question. I don't really know. It seemed like for a while there, I had a rhythm going with a freelance year, then a book writing year, then a freelance year, then a book writing year. And about every 2 years, one of those books needed to be updated. So just to keep it current. And the reason there's so many editions is they sell really well. So there was still, there was still enough of a demand for them. Now, the nutshell ended after three editions because it got to a point where you cannot put it all in a nutshell. Like, it's just, there's just too much stuff. When you look at the size of, Eric Meyer's CSS definitive guide, it's like 1,200 pages. You can't condense that down. And then the same thing with learning web design, which, and those books really have different roles. There's like the encyclopedia and then there's the class. But learning web design, it's really being used in classrooms mostly. I see a little spike in
That's killer. Does that help? I mean, I'm sure it helps the students, whatever, but it's got to help sales that if a book like this drops on a syllabus.
Well, yeah, you can see the royalties go up at the beginning of each semester. But what I'm working on now is to make it even better for instructors. I'm making a complete slide deck for the whole book. So every chapter has its own slide deck. It's like a super set.
What? And you get that when you buy the book?
Or for instructors, if they request it. And I'm also doing an instructor's guide that teaches you here's how the book is structured. Here's how I recommend, once you get to this chapter, you can skip ahead and do some other stuff and come back. And so we're trying to make it as easy as possible to make this a good classroom.
That could have a real impact. I mean, I think it's genius entrepreneurially, is that a word? But I like but even bigger deal is that if you can hand an instructor, say, here, this is how you teach web design and have that be, good, like this is, that can have a real impact on the next generation of people. That's so just very cool, I think.
I hope so. Yeah, so if there are any instructors, they should get in touch with me because I am working my little fingers to the bone right now trying to get this stuff done before the school year starts too much. So that's what I'm busy on now is all the instructor guides and slides, as I like to say.
No, that's...
I mean, I guess the negative side, the flip side of this is that there's probably, there's plenty of bad resources out there too, and professors or who knows, educators just doing their own thing and teaching outdated stuff and
ranges. There are HTML and CSS are taught in journalism school because people have to know how to put their things online, and they're taught as part of UX programs and art programs and computer science programs. So for the past whatever editions, I've been asked to make slides, but I've always been hesitant because how can you make slides for everybody's different approaches to it? But this time it just became evident, like, I really need to make slides. And so my approach is just this superset that you can take and reduce and mix and match to suit your needs. But
this is incredible. So that's the big, I think this feels like the like future of textbooks to me. This is like just that it would come with, you know, guides that instructors could then share the knowledge from the book. I think that's, I was driving this morning. I dropped my truck off to get, you know, fixed. It didn't have brake pads anymore. But then in between, next door, there's a Wendy's. And in between Wendy's and a bagel shop, there was a coder school. And it's kind of a coding school for kids. And I'm just thinking, like, if Dave Rupert was like, oh, I'm going to start a coding school for kids, I would be so overwhelmed with the business and, like, business growth and getting kids in there that, like, my instruction stuff would fall by the wayside, you know? I that would be so hard to do. But then, like, your book comes in with some guides on how to teach this stuff, and you could be, like, teaching kids how to code. I think that's so cool.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, that's helpful.
So what in here is, so there's new stuff.
Yes, oh, there's a lot of new stuff. There's grid. Hundreds of pages of new stuff. So yeah, Flexbox and Grid are the big ones. I also wrote, that chapter also had a section on multi-column layout, but that chapter was already like 75 pages long. So I cut that out and made it a PDF that you can download. It's at learningwebdesign.com. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there are a lot, there may be four additional chapters that were good stuff, but like the book was just already, you know, too heavy to carry around. So I just moved them off onto the website.
Border images. That's a good choice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like it doesn't need to be in the book, but it's nice to know.
Here's something that's too hard.
While we were planning for the show, I thought of that one too. I'm like, if you're writing a book about, and you want to touch on as much as you can, I mean, of course you got to cover CSS borders at some point. I mean, it's going to happen. You know, everything has a border. But border image?
That doesn't need to be in the paper book, yeah. So the last edition had maybe a sidebar or a couple of pages about responsive web design. This one has an entire chapter. Same thing with SVG. A little sidebar in the last edition. And now it has its own big chapter and also a lot in the markup section in, I guess, chapter 7 images chapter. The other thing that's new in this book that I haven't done before, but I'm really excited about it, is introducing some of the modern developer tools that are part of the job that I just think people should be familiar with. So it sort of started with wanting to let readers know about SAS and LESS and, you know, the preprocessors. And then I'm like, oh, well, then there's post-processors. And I'm like, oh, well, you're going to need to know the command line really to get into some of that stuff. So this chapter has, you know, command line, SAS and LESS, post CSS, task runners like grunt and gulp, and also a good introduction to Git, and mostly just Git terminology. It's hard to teach entirely, but I just know that, you know, up until recently, like, I didn't really know the difference between like Git and GitHub or between a branch and a fork. So I think just getting people up to speed with the terminology so that they can have a little head start to learning it is a decent thing to have in there. So I just wanted people to know, like, okay, you've learned the HTML, but here's what your job looks like. Here's the tools you're actually going to be using on the job.
It's funny it's picking a place to start. I always remember helping out at a beginner class for a while. And the way that class was structured is on the first day, the very first thing you learned curriculum wise was Git first. It was like, let's just start with Git. Here's the command line. Open it up. We're going to pull a repo. Now you see there's files. Change one of those files. We're going to learn how to commit it back. And it was kind of interesting because it was like, it didn't seem intuitive to me. It's always seemed like kind of a, I don't know, slightly more complex thing or what. But it worked out well because by the time, you know, I'd come halfway through the semester and they'd be like just starting to learn some kind of CSS concept, but they would learn it and I'd watch them, you know, pull this repo and run command line stuff. And I was like, whoa, you seem super advanced, but it was just the order in which they learned. They're very good at the Git part. And part of the curriculum of the class was that each like new thing that they learned was like a repo that they had to pull, and all there was tests in the repo that they had to run, and it felt cool because it was kind of like, well, you're going to need to know this,
right.
So maybe getting it out of the way is the first thing.
Well, the tricky thing for me is I didn't know that, so this is you know, a lot of the stuff in this book, I had to learn completely from scratch in order to write it. So for SVG, which I know about and, you know, basically, but enough to write it, I read like 2 800-page books by Amelia Bellamy Royds and decided, okay, out of those 1600 pages I just read, what are the 20 most pertinent pages of information for this overview book? And that's a lot of what I do for my books, is just read everything there is, try to sort it out and figure out, okay, what's the best, you know, how are my beginner readers best served? You know, and sometimes you can't teach everything. Like for JavaScript, which I don't know at all. I do not do JavaScript. Matt Marquis, actually, Wilto, the fabulous Wilto, wrote the 2 JavaScript chapters. And in a couple of chapters in a book like this, you can really only just talk about, you know, introduce things like variables and loops and get people familiar with it and be able to, you know, look at a script and basically know what's going on. But you can't really teach all of JavaScript in one chapter. So, but it, you know, it, the point, you know, the goal is just to get their feet wet, get them familiar with what it looks like and able to continue on with, you know, more exploration.
So is there anything surprising in here, particularly weird, favorite parts?
Surprising was just, was the graphics chapters. Just because I did not see that coming. I was completely blindsided by how much it changed in that landscape and that I'd have to write 3 completely new chapters when I thought I'd only have to make small tweaks. So that was my biggest surprise. Going into it, I knew that Flexbox and Grid would be monsters to learn. And that one chapter took me probably 3 months to write, just learning and trying things out and then just a lot of writing. It's a 75-page chapter. You know, that's like a whole, that's a book apart book right there.
Yeah.
Tucked in the middle of my book. So.
Put an image on a web page.
Yeah. So there's a whole lot more about responsive images. Yeah. There's always new stuff. And even some of the old stuff gets tweaked in surprising ways.
Mm-hmm. Are you ready, Dave? Do you want to take the SVG quiz?
Got it. Crack open my mouth editor. Here we go.
Dave, what is the most widely supported version of SVG? A, SVG Tiny, B, SVG 1.1, C, SVG 2, or D, SVG Electric Boogaloo?
Feeling D, but I don't think that's true. Let's see. This is tricky because SVG 1.1 seems like it would be the like broadest support because like, hey, we... like that's the youngest, but I'm going to go with SVG 2.1 because it feels like some browsers didn't come around to SVG quite that early. That's my guess. Is it 2.1?
I don't know the correct answer, but I'm pretty sure you're wrong. I think it's probably 1.1. Does Jen know?
I have to look it up. That happens all the time.
I know. I mean, well, there's probably thousands of questions in here.
Come on.
All right. Well, let's move on for now. Dave, name 3 ways to reduce the file size of an SVG. That should just be fun for spitballing.
Yeah. Well, SVG OMG or SVG Optum, is that what it's called? SVGO, is a good way. And then beyond that, my answers are more like, remove all the crud that Illustrator puts in there and then hand code your SVGs. That's my final answer.
Yeah. That's all I got too. The golf. Golf it.
So it was SVG 1.1 is the best supported. And reducing the size, and I'm totally just reading this out of the appendix. It's not off the top of my head, but simplifying paths, reducing the number of decimal places, using shapes instead of complex paths.
Yes.
Avoiding raster images and effects. Running it through an optimizer like SVGO, and enabling gzip compression on the server.
There you go. Oh, gzip is a big one. That's a.
Well, here's another reason why it's SVG2 is not as supported everywhere. It became a candidate recommendation on August 7th. 2018.
Oh, really? Well,
listening out there, we're recording this on August 23rd.
This is how much I know. 2018. I mean, I know you put like, you know, the XMLNS is SVG 1.1 or whatever, right? Yeah.
Namespacey
stuff. But yeah, maybe. Anyway, I laid out my reasoning. It did not work. So.
Well, just the fact that there's tests in here is so cool. I'm sure that it goes a long way in making it a textbook.
Yeah, I mean, it helps people who are self-taught, and I think it also helps out instructors because that part's done for them.
Mm-hmm. Man, we need some game show music. We'll have to make Chris do that in post and sort of then like tell him what he won, Chris. And then Chris tells me my prizes. This is going to be good.
Some things that were in old editions that are not in this edition. In the first edition, I had a whole chapter on frames.
Wow.
Remember frames?
Frame set.
I kind of don't. Like, what was a frame? I know that they were a thing. It's not like this is the first time I'm hearing of it. And I know what an iframe is. But what's the difference between an iframe and a frame?
You could divide up the whole window into frames and put frames in frames. So it's basically the same thing. It would be a nested browsing context, but it had its own DTD back in the day. You know, frames because it...
I don't even know what that is.
The doc type declaration.
Yeah.
Document type declaration. Yeah. So there was, I think it was in HTML 4.01, there was strict... There was a lax one. I can't remember what the official name for that one was. And then transitional, right? Transitional, strict, and frames because it used a different root element, I think. So they had to have it in a separate DTD. But yeah, I remember you just set up the frames at the top level and then you'd put HTML, you'd put your document in it just like an iframe.
So it was kind of like to make it kind of like app-like or something because like they would scroll.
Yeah, it was the only way to have a scrolling. Yeah, so it was popular for a little while there to have like all your navigation in a frame on the left side that scrolled and then your mainframe would stay the same for display.
And maybe there was no, like iframes are like sandboxed-ish, right? Like they can't talk to each other, but maybe in frames they could.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't know.
It was a while ago.
Like, one would be the parent, and you'd name the frames, and then you'd basically just say, you'd set up a frame.
You could click something in one frame, and another frame could react to it, maybe. This seems awesome. Why don't we bring this back?
Well, it was like frame set, and then you'd have frame source equals sidebar to HTML, and then frame source equals... content or whatever, page1.html. And then it was pretty awesome and it like worked pretty well. But I still remember the day I found out about iframes and I was like, I can have a frame inside a page. What? Like, my mind was blown. I rolled it out immediately, security errors and all. It was wonderful. It was amazing. I didn't realize that technology was possible. I still remember my first iframe. Ah, I could probably find it on my archives.
It's just there's like a lot of talk about like, oh, table markup is bad. We don't do that anymore. And you can like codify it pretty well. It'd be like, well, it's really source order dependent. And when you get there, like assistive technology like announces that it's a table and the way that you tab through it is very awkward and not content-like, and you're not really describing the content that's in it. You're using it for, layout purposes and not semantic purposes. And it's like, it was pretty easy to make that argument, but I've never heard anybody make the same type of full-throated anti-frames.
I think frames had a lot of just user interface issues. And also, your page is made up of lots of HTML files, which are, more hits on the server. And I don't know, there were just all sorts of reasons. Right. They're like, meh, never mind. Other things that didn't make the cut, I had a chapter in an early nutshell called Layout Techniques with HTML.
Ooh.
So the font tag.
Yes.
And the BG image attribute for tiling backgrounds with Ooh. HTML. Mm-hmm. There was a DHTML chapter. And, yeah. And I was surprised. I went back and looked before this interview. that there are 40 pages of CSS in the very first Nutshell book.
Whoa.
Which I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah.
But it was in a section called Emerging Technologies. And
99. Nice. This is 1999.
I think. Yeah, I wrote it in 98. So,
okay.
Yeah, so 20 years ago, there, you know, 40 pages is pretty significant, I think. I thought it wasn't in there at all, but yeah, it's there. And, but it's like, it's not supported in Netscape 4 or IE3. So,
yeah. What was the, like, was there some kind of like intro, like, if you do things this way, it like abstracts your styling away from your HTML, which is good.
Yes, I think that's in there. I think,
yeah.
Although it was really the second edition of the Nutshell that we got into the whole like layer cake thing, the, you know, the structural and presentation and behavioral. When I, you know, this is another case where I was going to just like make some tweaks to the first edition of the Nutshell to come out with the second. But between, you know, in that 2 years is when CSS completely took off. So I was still, you know, just trying to reuse old stuff like, oh, here's the, you know, font tag and here's the color attribute on the, you know, yeah, on the body tag. And it was actually Molly Holschlag who took an early look at it. She said, this is like putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. So, and I realized
you remember exactly what she said. Oh,
exactly. Because it's, and I'm like, what are you talking about? She said, there are people learning how to do web pages only with CSS who are not using tables at all, because I still have my layout tables section in the book. And I mean, it was, you know, you could not tweak. It was a, you know, a tectonic shift of, you know, of how we did everything. So yeah, that was a complete rewrite from first edition to second edition. Although it's interesting because embedded fonts, web fonts were in the first edition and then they went away for, you know, for 20 years. Yeah. And then they came back in this edition of Learning Web Design. So it's interesting how we like play around with things, put it down for a while, and then later it becomes a reality. Or things that were just sort of lurking in the distance for, you know, 20 years, like SVG. And even Ping took forever to catch on. You know, it was always available. And I think, you know, I think it was Greg Roloffs wrote books about it in 1988 or something, but it just took a really long time to see, you know, to really take advantage of it. So things are always changing.
One thing I noticed in your like supplemental articles, you pulled out floats, like page layout with floats and positioning, which is, I'm like, half like, you can't do that. And then I'm like, oh, yes, you absolutely can. And yes, you should. Like that does not need to be in the core web design book. Like, I think that's such a bold choice. And thank you for making that choice.
It felt bold. It really did. It felt like, wow, like this is just completely going out. And in the text, you know, where we're talking about page layout with Flexbox and Grid, it says like, if you need to support IE8 or other really old browsers, there is a way to do it with floats and positioning. But so if you are in that situation of needing to support those old browsers, you can read this article. It's all there from the last edition. But really, you know, it's always presented as, you know, an outdated way of doing things.
Wow. Yeah.
Which made the floats chapter a lot more straightforward, because it was truly about just floating things left and right, mm-hmm, and maybe putting some fancy shapes around them. Oh, and that was new in this edition, too. There weren't CSS shapes, okay, yeah, around.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a fun one. What a fun world. There's a pretty good, I think it was a Ben Frain article recently where he's playing with shit. Cause, I don't know, maybe I'm... I don't know if everyone would accuse me of this, but a bit of an optimist. Sometimes when I see CSS shapes, I'm like, oh, fun. And then I just like use it right away. And I'm like, oh, it's progressive enhancement friendly. This is sweet. And I use it. And then somebody will do a deep dive like he did and be like, these are all the things kind of wrong with it. Because there's basically shapes is like just it's a way to reshape a floated element so that the text wraps around the float in an interesting way. But that's kind of like outside only. It's like not possible to do that on the inside.
Right. Yeah, they're limited.
There's all these other kind of limitations of it that are a bit unfortunate. It's like in the fact that you've reshaped the floated element doesn't mean that any background you might have in that floated element is cropped away in any way. So it's like the thing that you float is essentially this ghost element and not anything useful. Like
And I ran into some, there's one that way that you can do that by using an image as the background, you know, as the basis for it. But I ran into a thing with, the cross origin security stuff, I couldn't have, it worked on my server, but it didn't work locally. And so it wasn't, it's tricky to put stuff like that with gotchas in a beginner book.
When you like make an SVG have the path in it to do the
or it just wouldn't do it because because of the URL of the image.
Yeah. I've literally seen that exact same thing. I know exactly what you're talking about. And you're like, why is that a cores thing? It's a CSS file referencing an image, just like a background image would be, in which it wouldn't throw a cores error. But if you use it for shape outside, it will throw a cores.
So,
oh my God.
Yeah, so there are all sorts of, you run into little gotchas like that. It's like, oh, this is so far beyond my beginner like conversational tone with this. So, I showed it anyway, but just made a little warning note that this might not work for you. And here's an article that tells you exactly why. Oh, the other thing about this book that, if you don't mind me patting myself on the back a little bit here, is I designed the interior of the book and laid out every single page.
That's super significant.
And that was, honestly, the most fun part of all.
What'd you use, InDesign, or did you rock it?
No, it's InDesign. It's probably the only book that O'Reilly does in InDesign anymore. There might be others, but it's so complex. It's sort of beyond their authoring tools that they use. They have everything so gorgeously.
I've been down this same road. That's the WordPress book I did back in the day. We did InDesign as well, and self did it. So I've been there. This is yours.
My background, I started as a book designer. I started working at Little Brown as a book designer and book production, and I was hired at O'Reilly as a book designer. And it was just one of those right place, right time that that the web came along and sort of swooped my entire career off with it. But boy, it was so fun doing the book design. I wish I could have spent 2 years doing book layout and 8 weeks writing the book because I would have been it would have been better balance. Yeah. But once the writing is so hard. I say it's just a bunch of emails, but it's really hard because I'm researching, I'm wading out into places, I'm just way over my head and don't know it. I have to learn everything. So the learning and
sure, everybody
learning and editing and writing and reviewing. And it's a very slow process.
The fact that it's like locked, it's not locked in stone. I mean, obviously you could make a sixth edition if you wanted to, but you really have to be right on any edition about what you're going to say. I found that to be one of the more stressful parts about any of this.
Yeah, it really solidifies it. It's hard to know. And I've come up with ways to make things a little more evergreen, it's like this. Yeah. Now these are the types of tools. Here's a page to go learn what the specific tools are when you're reading this book. But after that long slog of writing, when it was time to just sit and be in InDesign all day, like I come out of my room in the morning and just like singing, and there'd be animated birds chirping around my head, and like Snow White.
That was much more pleasurable.
It was because I got to listen to music. I love music, and when I'm writing, I can't have music on. Like not even for some reason, not even instrumental. Like I just have to have quiet. So I spent a year and a half quiet.
What design you can
designing when I'm doing visual stuff. Yeah, music on all the time, and just had a great time. Just it felt more like me. I don't know.
Wait for Jen's next book, book design,
in learning book design.
What, could you write a book about book design in InDesign? No, that would be...
It's probably been done.
Crazy.
One thing I'm just noticing from your little... Your book is full color, is that right? It's full color?
Yes.
Because you're in your little samples here, you're using kind of color to sort of like, you'll draw a red border around a div, and then you'll style the CSS for that div is written in red. So there's like some spatial stuff that's really clever, like in kind of you're associating those two things with color. I think that's, anyway, I don't know if you do that throughout the whole book, but that sort of stuff is cool. You're leveraging.
I do. I'm very conscious of how I'm using color throughout the book. One of the things in this new book design is I tried to reel back the number of colors. So just be very judicious with color. But whenever there's, you know, there's color use for highlighted code. And a lot of times, like you said, you know, I'll have like in the table discussion where I'm like first introducing tables, I draw a table like you'd see it on a page. And then I use, you know, three different colors to highlight the table itself, the rows and each cell in it. And then I translate that to words, and then I translate it to code, and then I translate it to just like how you would write it in HTML, maintaining those colors. So you're always seeing the relationship of, you know, what this green box is. Oh, and there it ends up as a opening table tag and an ending table tag when you see it in the code. So yes, I'm very, very conscious of using color. Also self-conscious because you're not everybody can use the color code. So I always make sure that there's at least, you know, a weight or something that compensates if you're not seeing the difference between the orange and the green.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's cool. Well, I think we need to wrap it up here. I realize I just looked at the clock and I think we're going over here, but I guess what's one thing you want to say to somebody who's looking to learn web design would be your advice here, Jen?
If you're starting from scratch, I think the important thing to keep in mind is you don't have to learn everything all at once. So I would say work to your strengths already and learn, you know, there's just so many parts of web design, so many disciplines within it that you can sort of find your spot in it with something that feels familiar and build from there. So yeah, you don't need to learn everything at once. You can start small and, you know, just add on things as you need them, which I think a lot of web developers do. You know, learning JavaScript, you start by finding a script and just editing one little part to make it do what you want. And then you feel a little more comfortable adding a little more and, you know, you become familiar with that way. So when you look at this 800-page book, it's like, oh, how am I going to learn all of that? Well, you don't need to learn all of it. In fact, I wrote it and I'm looking things up in it constantly. So, yeah, you don't have to keep it all in your head and you don't have to learn everything at once. I think that would be it.
Awesome.
I love that advice. Thanks, Jen.
And thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. For people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Well, buy books, I suppose. keep an ear out for Artifact Conference if that ever comes along. The more people say they want it, the more likely we are to pull ourselves together to do it. And I don't know, just say hello sometime.
Perfect. At Jenville on Twitter. We'll put a link in the show notes. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. We've been looking over some reviews recently, so we'll share some of those, some of the gems. We'll share some of those soon. And thank you for downloading this. We really appreciate it. Follow us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter for tens of tweets a month. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, shoptalkshow.com.